So in this lecture, we're going to continue talking about the string diagrams that I started introducing at the beginning, at the end of last time. And then we're going to move on to talk a bit about the generalized formalism of quantum theory. So let me just remind you where we were up to at the end of last time. I'd introduced these things that are called the Yanking axioms. Okay, so these delta tensors, so this cup here, it represents this delta tensor with two upper indices. This cap represents the delta tensor with two lower indices. And you can also think of them as unnormalized maximally entangled states. So this thing represents an unnormalized maximally entangled state, and this represents the dual vector to that. Okay, and they obey these Yanking axioms, which basically tell us that you can treat these lines as if they were pieces of string, and pull, you know, if you have a curved line, you can pull them straight. Okay, so we introduced that. And then towards the end of last time, I introduced the definition of the transpose. So the transpose means that I just alter the locations of the indices. So I switch all upper indices to lower indices and lower indices to upper indices by contracting them with the delta tensors. So diagrammatically, what it means is that we define, so if we have this operation here, we define its transpose by connecting wires that turn an upper index into a lower index and a lower index into an upper index. And that's what we mean by the transpose of a tensor. And I also introduced this little bit of syntax here to make things look a bit nicer. So if, instead of using square boxes for our tensors, if we introduce a little bit of asymmetry, so I'm going to put a diagonal side on one edge, then we can represent the transpose as rotating this box by 180 degrees. So if you think about this in terms of strings, if I were to take this diagram, which represents the transpose, hold onto the strings and pull them straight, then it would make this box rotate around 180 degrees. And in that way, we can identify a rotated box with the transpose of this box, so diagrammatically. All right, so to show some application of this, let's have a little bit of fun. Let's prove something, just purely diagrammatically. So what this equation says here is if I have a maximally entangled state, the phi plus state, and I apply some operation, some, this could be a unitary operation, for instance, to the left-hand system, then that gives me the same thing as if I apply the transpose to the right-hand system. Okay, so if I have the phi plus state, let me write out the equation that we're proving just in Dirac notation as well. So if we have the phi plus state on system A and A prime, then what I'm saying is that if I apply an operation, say a unitary to system A, then that's the same thing as applying the transpose of the unitary to A prime. Okay, so this is a common equation that's proved in, used in a lot of quantum information protocols, but we can prove it purely diagrammatically now by using the Yanking axioms. So what we do is we start off here, and then we can use the Yanking axiom, let's see, this one. So we start, take an identity wire, we can transform it into this. We can go from here to here. So let's do that. So take this bit of wire here, and we can put this curvy thing there. Okay, and now if I look inside this dotted box here, this is the definition of the transpose that I gave. Right, it just turns this upper index into a lower index, this lower one into an upper one. So I can replace that with the transpose, and there we have the equation on the right-hand side. So without having to write down any equations in Dirac notation or anything like that, I can already prove things using these axioms. And what this also shows you is that you can, in some sense, for this proof, forget about the Yanking axioms, because what this proof shows you is that you can slide boxes along wires. So if you imagine that these boxes were like beads on a string, you can slide them around the string however you like. And obviously, you could prove the same thing with a cup as well as a cap as well as a cup. So I could slide boxes around the tops of caps as well, just completely freely. Okay, so that was a transpose, but there are two other notions which are also important. One is the conjugate. So with the conjugate of a tensor, so by the way, this actually the notion of a transpose and the notion of a conjugate assume that you have a preferred basis that you're working in, right? So the reason that that's true for the transpose is that this maximally entangled state is defined with respect to particular basis that you chose to use for defining phi plus. So with the conjugate, you take the representation of your tensor in a particular basis, and you just take the complex conjugate of all the coefficients there. Okay, so the coefficients of psi star are just the stars of the coefficients of psi. And in a diagram, we're going to represent this conjugation by reflecting it in a vertical axis, by reflecting the box in the vertical axis. Okay, so if I, so this is the same as this. Okay, so phi star is just phi rotate reflected in the vertical axis. We'll see why we're going to do this in a minute, because there's also another notion, which is the adjoint, which, you know, as you know from just the theory of operators, the adjoint of an operator is the complex conjugate transpose. So the dagger operation consists of doing both complex conjugate and transpose in either order, because they commute. So first we take the complex conjugates of the coefficients, and then we transpose, or the other way around. So we take psi star, and then we raise and lower all the indices. Now, for consistency with what we have before, this should be represented by reflection in the horizontal axis, because when we take a complex conjugate, we reflect in the vertical axis, and then when we take the transpose, we rotate by 180 degrees. So for consistency, we need to represent adjoints by reflection in the horizontal axis. Okay, so here's basically a summary of all that diagrammatically, right? So if we start over here, flipping in the vertical axis conjugates any of these boxes. So these pairs are represented by related by conjugation. These reflections are related by adjoints, and the transpose by 180 degree rotation like that. Okay, so all of this together, so if we take these diagrams with boxes, we have the Yanking axioms, we have the definitions of conjugate, transpose, and adjoint. These are called string diagrams. They've been called string diagrams. And the reason they're called string diagrams is that you can prove from the axioms that we have is that everything that you can do in these diagrams by just imagining the wires are made of string, rotating the boxes around and sliding them along the strings, corresponds to a valid mathematical proof that you could prove otherwise directly in just with the tensor notation. Okay, so string diagram manipulations are basically mathematical proofs themselves. So if we can see something in the diagrams, then we don't also need to go and do the mathematics and figure it out in components. All right, so a couple of other notions. The trace of an operator. So if we have an operator from a Hilbert space to itself, then the trace is just the sum of the diagonal coefficients. Now, in abstract index notation, that means that we have to contract this index with itself. So I can sort of expand that out by introducing two delta tensors like this, right? Now I've got two different indices there, and I'm relying on these deltas to do the contraction. And you can see that diagrammatically, what does this represent? Well, I've got the two delta tensor wires are going to be contracted together and then connected to the psi. So basically, it's a closed loop, like this. Okay. If you remember the red diagrams where I treat this as a Ket space, I only have one wire in this case, so I can't represent the trace as any kind of loop in those diagrams. So we use this. So it just means get rid of the system kind of thing. When you trace a density operator, you're left with one, right? So it means like basically throw the system away. I didn't put this in the slides, but it's interesting. You can very easily prove the cyclic property of the trace with everything that we have now. So if you remember the trace of A, B, C, etc., is trace of C, A, B. So I can take these operators and rotate them around cyclically within the trace. This is kind of easy to prove because you basically just do a Ferris wheel. Right, so if I have these three boxes connected together and then I take the trace, then if I want to get C at the front, I'm just going to take C and rotate it around this string, right? So I can go from here to here. And then we'll have the transpose of C over here. So I'm going to get the angles right. So I'm straight here, and I'm going to be like this here. So that's a transpose of C round here. And then I'm going to bring C round to the bottom. Right, so that's a very simple diagrammatic proof of the cyclic property of the trace. I literally just take this box and thread it around the string to the bottom. Okay. Now the partial trace, this is going to be important because, as you know, partial traces are how we marginalize over subsystems in quantum theory. So when we do a full trace, we just contract all of the top indices with the bottom indices, providing they're the same label. A partial trace, we just do that for some of them, right? So if I have an operator from AB to AB, and I just contract the A index around like this, and that's a partial trace, like this. So basically, it means summing over the A indices in this case. So summing over, tracing out just the A indices and leaving the B indices alone. So that will be represented diagrammatically by just having a loop on the A index and nothing on the B, leaving the B index alone. Right. All right. So here's something else that we can prove, we can understand in diagrammatic notation. So there's a correspondence between vectors and operators, which basically, I've written it up here, right? So there's an isomorphism between the operators from A to B. We know that this is actually equal to the dual of A tensor B, as that we discussed last time. Now, we know that there's an isomorphism between vectors and dual vectors in a product space, right? So we can we can basically flip kets into bras and vice versa, right? So doing that will give us a correspondence between operators and just vectors on the tensor product. So basically, if I take an operator and I just raise this index, flip this to a ket, then I get an operator on the tensor product, sorry, a vector on the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. So this is this looks a bit cleaner in both abstract index notation and in diagrams. So in diagrams, we're saying, okay, take an operator, raise the index, you get a vector. And you can see this thing starts as an operator, but if I connect it to a cup like this, I now have two upward indices, so it's a vector. And similarly, if I start with a vector and I lower one of the indices, I will get an operator. And that works looks like this in diagrammatic notation. Okay, so now with everything that we had, we can get rid of the awkward kind of boxes that we had. So if you remember, if I wanted to contract an operator from B to A with an operator from A to B, then I had to draw this one as a funny box because that's the only ways we could get the indices to the wires to match. But now, since I have the notion of these raising and lowering operators and so forth, I know that if I take the transpose, well, if I take actually the transpose of this guy and connect it with a wire like this, that's going to be the same thing as that. So it's just basically take this box and squash it into a proper just parallel, just one of these slightly asymmetric boxes. So take these bits and squash it round. In order to do that, I'm going to have to bend these wires around. And so you'll get this. So we can get away now without ever having to write awkward boxes that don't have four sides. All right. Okay, so now this is basically, we've covered pretty much everything we need to know about string diagrams. But what I'd like to do is give you an application to show what you can prove something diagrammatically that we've already seen before. It's somewhat cleaner diagrammatically, so let's see it. And that's teleportation. So if you remember, I think it was last lecture, I was talking about teleportation. So if you have the maximally entangled state here, you have Alice has an unknown input state. She makes a four outcome measurement in the Bell basis on those two systems, transmits the outcome to Bob, and he can do a unitary operation which corrects this system B, and then he ends up with Alice's unknown state. Okay, and this was the way the protocol worked. I've just said it. They share the two qubits in the maximally entangled state. Alice performs a joint measurement of her two systems, and then Bob does the unitary correction. Okay, so let's see how that is going to look diagrammatically. So what I want to point out is that this yanking axiom here already sort of looks a bit like teleportation, right? Because what does it say? So here I've put the system labels back in. So if we consider this to be system A, this system A prime, this system B, then the state here on A prime B is this unnormalized maximally entangled state. The state on A and A prime is this dual state. So what this axiom actually says is if I can track this with this, so if I roughly speaking measure delta on system A and A prime, this gives me an identity from A to B. Okay, so this already looks a little bit like teleportation, except for the correction and the normalization. Okay, so this is what I want to say. So here's the teleportation protocol. I've omitted here that obviously there's a state input here. So if you consider the teleportation protocol in the case where Alice gets the phi plus outcome up here, then these states are just 1 over root 2 times this delta tensor. So this whole diagram is just a half times this diagram. And this thing I can pull straight. So I get a half times the identity. So if I stuck a state in here, I get as the output half times that state. So I get an identity channel up to a factor of a half. This factor of a half is just going to be a scalar that's in front of the output state. And if I want to know the probability of getting that output state, I have to take its mod squared. So it tells you that this outcome happens with probability a quarter. And if I get that outcome, the whole thing just acts as the identity. Okay, so now we have to deal with the other three outcomes. So remember, with the other three outcomes, I have to, that the output at Bob's side is the same as the input, except there's a unitary transformation that's been applied to it, and I have to undo that unitary transformation. Now there's four unitary matrices. What happened to two? Two is missing. Okay. Zero to four. They're orthogonal in the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. You can verify that. So they were actually just, let me write them out, I think. So the four unitary correction matrices, so U0 was just the identity. One of them was this, just the Pauli X matrix. The only difference from the Pauli matrices is that they're real. So this guy was 0, I think it was 0 minus 1, 1, 0. It might have been that the minus 1 was down here, but it doesn't make a difference. So these were the three matrices. The four matrices, rather. And if you check their inner product, in the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, you'll find that they're orthogonal. So if I take these four boxes, we know that there's this vector operator correspondence. So I can turn any one of these unitary operators into a vector by raising this index. And this will give me some sort of state on a bipartite system. And the correspondence, it's easy to see that the correspondence preserves inner products. So if these unitary operators were orthogonal in the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, then these states are going to be still orthogonal. Okay, and you can check that these states through this vector operator correspondence are just the Bell basis states that we defined, the measurement basis that we're using. Okay, so we proved earlier that I can take an operator and move it around the cup, and it just becomes its transpose. Okay, so let's generalize this. Let's suppose I have one of these unitaries acting here, then I can thread it round to here, and then this part here, by the yanking axioms, I can pull straight. Okay, so something that looks like this, well, all you're really doing here is taking these two ends of the string and pulling it straight. This box will rotate around when you do that, so you get this. Okay. Right. All right, so basically, this is what you're doing. So instead of measuring in the state, instead of getting the measurement outcome phi plus, this state here, this measurement state, is one of the four Bell basis states. So you can see that if I do the same manipulations as I did for the phi plus outcome, then I get the identity channel up to this unitary here. Right? So the total effect of getting that measurement outcome is to perform actually the conjugate transformation of U. Right? So if this is U, then it's the transpose, right? Well, okay, if I define U with a diagonal this way, then that's the conjugate. Okay. The point is that Bob can undo it. It's just a unitary. He can undo it by doing adjoint of it. Okay. So if we include Bob's correction in the teleportation protocol, then the way we can prove it works is that we take this unitary, which is part of the definition of this basis measurement, we thread it round here, and then we see that we have the unitary and its adjoint, so that's going to give me the identity, and then we pull the wire straight and it's just the identity. Are there any questions about that? So, I mean, at least I think it's kind of nice that you can prove the whole thing works pretty much without ever writing down any states in direct notation, without doing any inner products by hand. It's all just wires and strings, boxes and strings. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to the next section, which is to talk about the generalized formalism. And part of the point, well, actually one of the main points of covering string diagrams is that when we get to start talking about completely positive trace preserving maps, which will probably be next time, then we can prove some things much more easily with diagrams that require a lot of hairy manipulation of indices if you try to do it by hand with just direct notation. So you'll see that some of the proofs in section 5 will make some heavy use of the diagram notation. Okay, so I want to first of all briefly revisit this idea of the two churches of quantum theory that I talked about a couple of lectures ago. So if you remember, church of the larger Hilbert space idea is that we should think of quantum theory as a dynamical theory, something like a classical field theory, but obviously it's got a weird object called the wave function in place of a classical field. Wave functions can be entangled and things like that, so it's not quite straightforward. But ultimately, you want to derive everything in quantum mechanics from the idea that there's a quantum state, in principle, a quantum state of the entire universe, a pure quantum state, just evolving unitarily according to the Schrödinger equation. That's the point of view of the Church of the larger Hilbert space. Obviously, measurements are a problem. So for the purposes of this part of the course, we will also allow ourselves to do projective measurements on that state. But when we get into interpretations, people who believe in Everett many worlds interpretation think that you can derive that structure too. That structure is also emergent. But for today, we won't go that far. And then the Church of the small Hilbert space point of view says something strange. What's really happened is something strange has happened to our physical variables. And then we have to try and find out how to make a consistent probability theory over those variables. And when you do that, you get quantum theory. Okay. So it's kind of, I think, interesting that you can derive the whole structure of the generalized formalism, in fact, much of the structure of quantum theory itself, from either this point of view or this point of view, and they happen to match each other. So I will give both the Church of the larger Hilbert space point of view and the Church of the smaller Hilbert space point of view on every construction. All right, so before that, we need a little bit more mathematics. I talked already about the Hilbert space of operators from Hilbert space A to Hilbert space B. That's a complex Hilbert space. It has an inner product given by the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. Okay, so since this is a Hilbert space, yeah, it's got more than one orthonormal basis. So the kind of standard basis that we have been using, the one that I've called these red kets, is just take the basis elements of each of the spaces and tensor product them together. Okay, and that indeed forms an orthonormal basis because the inner product of these things is just, so it's the dagger of this acting on that. So the B's go together and the A's go together and you get delta functions. Okay. So clearly from this, if dA is the dimension of Hilbert space A and dB is the dimension of Hilbert space B, clearly this has dimension dA times dB. But this isn't the only orthonormal basis, of course. We've actually already more or less seen this, like it's what I said here, up to a factor of I on this U2. If I take, for example, if I take the linear operators from a two-dimensional Hilbert space to a two-dimensional Hilbert space and define the three Pauli operators and the identity, then actually if I wanted them to be orthonormal, I have to divide these matrices by 1 over root 2. So if I define these SJs to be 1 over root 2 times this, then you'll find that the trace of SJ dagger SK is delta JK as well. So these operators also form a basis for that space. So consequently, for example, every 2x2 operator can be written as a linear combination of Pauli operators and the identity with the coefficients given by the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. And I don't need a dagger here because these are all Hermitian operators. Okay. Right. So now, if the input spaces and the output spaces are the same, then we can obviously define Hilbert's Hermitian matrices on that space. So if I'm talking about the operators from Hilbert space A to Hilbert space A, then I can define complex conjugate transpose. So I can define the set of Hermitian matrices for which these things are equal. Complex conjugate transpose. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so the set of Hermitian matrices, which I'm going to note S, is also a Hilbert space, but it's a real Hilbert space. Okay, so it's a Hilbert space with real coefficients. Because the point is that if I take any two Hermitian matrices and I take a linear combination of them with real coefficients, I still get a Hermitian matrix. If I were to multiply it by an imaginary coefficient, it wouldn't be Hermitian anymore. So to stay within the set of Hermitian matrices, I have to only take real combinations of the matrices. Okay, right. So the coefficients have to be real, and the inner product is inherited from the larger space, the space in which these are embedded in. But you'll find that the inner product of any two Hermitian operators is always real, right? So it forms an inner product space over the field of real numbers. Now the dimension of this space is still d squared, but now it's d squared real parameters, right? So the dimension of this space, sorry, if it's LHA, the dimension of that space is d squared, dimension of a squared complex parameters. This is d squared real parameters. And the way you can see that is that a Hermitian matrix has d real parameters down its diagonal, and then right, so then there's two parameters, two complex parameters in every spot in the upper diagonal here. Sorry, two real parameters, so a complex number in every spot here. But once I've determined those, the ones down here are completely determined. Okay, so I've got two times the number of parameters in the upper triangle here, real parameters. And that's d minus 1 times d in this upper triangle here. When I sum those together, I get that there's d squared real parameters specifying Hermitian matrix. So when we're thinking about Hermitian matrices, these basis states for the set space of linear operators aren't Hermitian. But since we have a real Hilbert space, we must be able to find an orthonormal basis of Hermitian matrices. We already saw one for the case of C2, these Pauli operator basis. That's an orthonormal basis. And in general, you can generalize this. If I take these combinations, which sort of look a bit like these. So every combination of J and K and J and K here, these are obviously Hermitian. However, you have to be careful with the counting of them. So they're not all different, and they're not all non-zero. So for example, if I take J equals K down here, this would be 0. So that's not one of the operators in my basis. So if you count how many different ones of these operators there are, you get d squared orthonormal Hermitian matrices. So that's just to show you that a basis exists. It doesn't really matter too much for what we're doing, what that actually is. Okay, and the other thing that's relevant is that Hermitian matrices are self-dual. So what do I mean by that? So remember, we've got the set of Hermitian matrices. The dual space to that is the set of functions from Hermitian matrices, linear functions from Hermitian matrices to real numbers. That's what a dual to a Hermitian matrix is. Okay, so the dagger of this space consists of linear functions from Hermitian matrices to the real numbers. But because the set of Hermitian matrices is a Hilbert space, the inner product still induces an isomorphism between the Hermitian matrices themselves and elements of the dual space. Okay, so here's how we can do that. So if we write a Hermitian matrix in terms of a Hermitian basis, self-adjoint basis, you'll have real coefficients in that basis. And then I can define a dual operator just by taking the dagger of everything. But because this is Hermitian, it's just the same operator that we started with. So actually a vector is, and the way the dual vectors act, of course, in the operator space, in the operator space, as we saw, if I have, how do I want to write it? I want to do red kets here. We don't have any red chalk, do we? Yes, we do. Okay, so if I'm taking the inner product between two operators, M and N, those are red kets because they're in the operator space. This is a trace of M dagger N. Okay, so if you have a Hermitian operator, so you can also think of this as the action of a dual vector on a vector. So a dual vector acts on a vector by multiplying by the dagger and then taking the trace. That gives you a real number in the case of Hermitian matrices. Okay, so in the case of Hermitian matrices, taking the dagger here gives you the same thing that you started with. So a vector is its own dual vector in that space, basically, when you have Hermitian matrices. This one I didn't want to bother doing. I don't know why that's still in there. Okay. right, so now let's talk about density operators. So let's look at the view from the Church of the Larger Hilbert space. So according to the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, the universe is always in some pure state vector. If we use any other mathematical object ever for describing the state of a quantum system, then it must be because we're only looking at a subsystem of the universe. Okay, so let's carve out the state space into the system that we're interested in, HS, tensor product with some environment. Okay, so if that whole thing is in a pure state, then I will be able to write down some joint state of the whole system in the tensor product space, or in abstract index notation this, or in diagrammatic notation that, okay? Now, let's suppose we're only interested in system S. We're never going to look at the environment, so we're only going to make measurements on system S. So let's suppose we make a projective measurement on system S. Pi here is the projector. So the probability of getting the outcome corresponding to the projector pi is just given by the Born rule, the inner product here. Right? We're doing nothing on the environment, so we put the identity there. And we have the projector here. And you can write that out in abstract index notation. You can see that basically what happens is that the environmental indices get contracted out. They just get summed over. And we do the computation with the system indices like this. So diagrammatically, it's sort of easy to see what's going. Here's the vector, here's the dual vector, here's the projection operator, and the environment just gets connected like an identity. So I can write this out differently by if I decide to switch the positions of these two things. So if I decide to bring this thing down to the bottom and that thing up to the top, then I can rewrite the diagram like this. Note that the projection operator has been flipped. In order to do that, the projection operator has been flipped in the vertical, but that's just the adjoint, and the projection operator is Hermitian, so it's actually the same projector. Okay. And both these diagrams are the same in red notation as doing this. So this is the projector onto psi, which is a combination of these two as an operator. Apply the projector here and get rid of the environment. Okay, so now what we can basically do is say, all right, let me consider, so because I'm interested in possibly making an arbitrary measurement on the system, let me consider what happens if I take this projector out of the diagram. Then you can see that the object, that is these two things, contracted on this index, is what you need to compute all the measurement probabilities. Right, so if I take this object, right, and contract out the environment, then I'm left with an operator from S to S, this thing rho, which is the density operator. Okay, so in more familiar Dirac notation, it means take the partial trace over the environment, contract out the environment indices in this pure state. And in red notation, it means that we define the density operator as just throw away the environment here. So you see here, the point of the red diagrams is this here looks more like what you actually do in the lab. You have two systems and you throw one of them in the garbage, right? Whereas this diagram here doesn't, although it's mathematically correct, of course, doesn't look like sort of anything that you operationally do in the lab. Okay, so then the probability rule is just attach the projector to the system. And so it's, if I look here, it's going to be, once I've traced this out, it's going to be another trace over S multiplied by the projection operator. So the probability rule for getting pi is just this contraction here. Just take the trace of pi and rho. So we've seen that rho lives in the space HS tensor HS dagger, which is the same thing as the linear operators on S, since we're going from S to S, it's also the same thing as the dual of the linear operators from S to S. So we can think of a density operator either as an operator, or you can think of it as a linear functional from operators to numbers, right? So the density operator is both an operator and a duperator. So normally in the literature, we call it a density operator, but it's kind of funny because we actually use it as a duperator. What we're interested in is give me an operator, projection operator, use the density operator to assign a probability to it, a number. So we actually use it as something that's dual to the space of operators. But since those things are isomorphic, it doesn't really matter. Okay, so I'm just gonna, so we've determined how to determine the density operator if you have the joint state. We don't know what properties a density operator has to satisfy. You've probably seen this before, but let me just go over this. So a positive operator is an operator that satisfies this constraint. So if I sandwich it between any state, I always get a positive number. And then you can prove, you've probably seen this before, that an operator is positive if and only if it's self-adjoint and it has positive eigenvalues. So I'm not going to dwell on the details of this. They've probably seen this before, right? Hey, no? Not in this form. Okay. So one way you can prove that it's self-adjoint is by looking at this equation and take two arbitrary states, phi and chi, and form the state phi plus I chi and the state phi minus I chi. Then substitute this into that formula and substitute this into that formula. This gives you two equations, which if you have a positive operator, both of these should be positive. And then if I take this equation, subtract that equation, and divide the whole thing by 2i, the point is to get rid of these terms. Then we'll be left with what we get from those terms. And if you rearrange that, then you find it's equal to this. And that's the definition of a self-adjoint operator. So because phi and chi could have been arbitrary operators here, positive implies self-adjoint. Now, a self-adjoint operator, you know, has real eigenvalues. But positivity means that if I take the inner product, so now let's let this be an eigenvector. If I take this, I should get just the eigenvalue. And so if this is positive, it means the eigenvalues are positive. And then conversely, if you have an operator, diagonal operator that's diagonal in the basis phi j with positive eigenvalues, then you can easily show that you get that this operator is positive. So if I contract it with any psi, then if I write it in the eigenbasis, I get this. This is just the mod squared inner product here. So this term is positive, the eigenvalues are positive, the whole thing's positive. Okay? Right, so that's one characterization of a positive operator. You can characterize a positive operator either as an operator that satisfies this or as a self-adjoint operator with positive eigenvalues. Those are equivalent. Now, here's another equivalent way of characterizing positive operators. An operator n is positive if and only if it can be written as n dagger times n for some other operator. Now, remember, n doesn't have to have the same input and output Hilbert spaces, right? Because remember, if n is a map from HA to HB, n dagger will be a map from HB to HA. And so this whole product here will still be an operator just on HA. Okay, so you don't have to have the same input and output Hilbert spaces for A. Okay, so let's prove these are equivalent. So first of all, if m is equal to n dagger n, then if I sandwich m between psi, I get this. And this is just the norm squared of n psi. Okay? It's the inner product of a vector with itself, which by the axioms of inner products must be positive. Now, conversely, let's use the equivalent definition where a positive operator is a self-adjoint operator with positive eigenvalues. Then I can define a square root of that operator by just keeping the eigenbasis the same and using the square roots of the eigenvalues. And then this operator is self-adjoint. So then I can see that m is equal to n dagger n for some n, that n being n to the half. Okay. Right, so any operator that can be written as n dagger n is positive, and any positive operator can be written as n dagger n for some operator. All right, so this will help us to prove the properties of the density operator, okay? So first of all, if the state that we started with on the system and environment is normalized, it means that when I take the inner product of psi with itself, I must get one. So that means that now, if you look, the trace of the density operator, if I substitute the definition of the density operator, where is it? Here. So I just contract the environment indices. So if I look at the diagonal components, jj, then all I have to do is change this to a J, and then you can see that the trace of this is just in a product of the original states. Right, so if I look at these coefficients, so remember there's a summation convention here, so this is the trace. That's just the inner product of psi with itself. So if the original state was normalized, then the density operator is normalized in the sense that it has trace one. Okay, and then what I want to do is prove, what I want to do is prove that it's positive. Right, so, so I'm defining the density operator like this, with a vector, contraction between a vector and a dual vector. I can take these vector and dual vectors, and I can lower one of the indices here, raise one of the indices there, and then it will be a contraction of two operators with one vector index and one dual vector index, right? So, like this. So I claim that this is the same thing as the density operator. So let's prove that. Here's the definition of the density operator. Actually, it's not the definition. Yeah, it's with E contracted out. And then I can introduce contractions with the delta tensor like this. I just want to lower the ins index and raise that index. And then I noticed that because these indices were contracted, the L indices were contracted, on my delta tensor, I used to have two L indices. So I can switch, I can use this to basically replace this contraction here with just this identity, Kronecker delta. And now I can, I can use that to, yes, okay. So the point is that I can replace, I can replace this ME here because there's a contraction here with just NE. This is the action of the identity on that state. So you end up seeing that actually I can contract these two operators and that gives me the same density operator. This is just like this guy is related to this guy by the vector operator correspondence. Okay, so I don't know how useful the diagrams are, but we start off with the definition of the density operator looking like this, and all I really do is use the vector operator correspondence to turn these things into operators rather than states on the tensor product. Anyway, the point of this is that now that I've written it like this, you can see that rho is of the form n dagger n, where the n operator is just this vector operator correspondence. So I take that bipartite state, convert it into an operator using the vector operator correspondence, and then this is of the form n dagger n, so it's a positive operator. So in summary, we've proved that the density operator, it must be positive, and must have trace equal to one. And now we have another question, which is, suppose I give you any positive trace one operator, can it arise as a density operator from ignoring the environment? And the answer to that question is also yes. So here's the way I do it. If I take my operator, take its square root, and act it on half of one of these delta states, so unnormalized maximally entangled state, then that's a state that has these coefficients, okay? And it's a pure state, it's a vector. And you can easily prove that if I take this state and trace out the system S prime, I get rho S, okay? So this is an example of a purification of a density operator. A purification means if you give me a density operator, find me a pure state on the system and environment that has that as its partial trace. In general, a density operator has multiple different purifications. This is just a sort of canonical way of constructing one of them, but you can see that there's actually an ambiguity, because if I do any unitary operator on the S prime system, then that doesn't change what the partial trace of this vector is. So there's at least a unitary degree of freedom. Actually, there's an isometry degree of freedom, but let's say there's a unitary degree of freedom in the different purifications of the same state. All right, are there any questions about any of that? No, I sort of went rather quickly through some of it. Okay, 4 minutes. So I just wanted to, this is more diagram fun. It's a common question. It's a common, I don't want to say, like homework problem to give somebody in quantum information once you've introduced a partial trace to prove that if you have a maximally entangled state and you take a partial trace, you find the density operator representing system A, that that's a maximally mixed state, the identity over 2. Okay, in diagrams, this is, I mean, it's not that hard to do anyway, but in diagrams, this is truly easy. So remember that delta is just the unnormalized version of the maximally entangled state, so it's root 2 times the maximally entangled state. So if I have that the partial trace of this operator is the identity, then I will automatically get this one, okay? And so what does this look like? So I've got the delta state, that's the delta state. This is the delta state. This is the dual of the delta state. So that's the bra. This is the bra. That's the ket. And then I'm taking a partial trace, so that means connect these things around in a loop. Now, if you know, well, the Yanking axioms basically tell you I can pull string straight. So you can pull this string straight, and that's the identity. That's the proof. It's actually not hard to do it manually, but I hope you think that that's at least much easier than the proof. And this is a real proof, by the way. It's not like you might think, oh, diagrams are just aids that help me and I have to go and do the real calculation. No, if this is true in diagrams, it must be true. It's an actual proof. Any questions about that? All right. Low on time, so maybe I should start. Maybe we should do the smaller Hilbert space view at the beginning of next time, since we only have a couple of minutes left. Any questions, comments, complaints? Yeah.
Yeah, when you do these axioms, the Yanking axioms and the diagrams and papers, is there some sort of package that you can use to write them easily, or just draw them by hand?
You mean to draw them or to do proofs with them?
Well, I guess both.
Okay, so to draw them, I mean, it's not great. So I think, I think it was Chris Hoynan made a package which lets you, so if you have a tablet, which lets you basically draw one of these things by hand, and then it will convert it into something that looks nice. So I did actually have a go on that to try and draw these diagrams, but I found it's not working that well at the moment. Okay, so in principle, people use a bunch of TIKZ things on top of TIKZ in LaTeX, but I find it still pretty complicated, so I haven't really used them. There is, on the other side, there is a package to do automated reasoning with these things, actually with much more than just string diagrams, includes much more stuff. It's called Quantumatic, that you can download. It's still in development, but sort of the core engine works pretty well, and that package will do diagram manipulations for you automatically. So that exists. But yeah, drawing them is still, I'm still doing it by hand. I know that people who've written books on this subject have sweated long and hard. Probably the thing that's probably taken them the longest time is coding up in TIKZ all of these all of these different things. So there needs to be sort of a better way of doing it, but there isn't. Anything else? Okay, in that case, I will see you tomorrow.